The program is up front. My name is Brian Edwards Teeker. Continuing our interviews with the candidates drawing the most independent expenditure money on the state ballot, the candidates for State Superintendent of Public Instruction. On to the one with the most money behind him, largely from pro-charter outfits. Marshall Tuck worked in finance. Then he ran a network of charter schools in Los Angeles. He has worked for many years at school reform organizations. Here's our conversation.
I've done this work before, not at the state level, but I've led two public school systems here in Los Angeles, all serving the lowest performing communities and the lowest income communities in Los Angeles. So my work's been in Watts and South LA and East LA and helped turn around the lowest performing schools. We've doubled graduation rates, had significant success. And so I want to do that across California. And, you know, where do we start? I always start with teachers and principals. You know, most important thing in a school for a child is the teacher in front of that child and the principal who supports that teacher. And we've got a 10,000 person teacher shortage in the state of California. We got to get serious and focused right away on getting more people to come in this profession and help support them. I want to move and work with the governor to put forward a free college if you commit to teach for 5 years or more as a way to incent people to come work in the teaching profession. Second, we got to focus on our funding. We're one of the lowest funded states in the country. We need to increase our funding, but we also, Brian, need to make sure that funding's getting to the kids of greatest need. And one responsibility the state superintendent has is on day one, you know, there's a lot of additional money that was passed by the legislature that said we're going to give more dollars to low-income kids and to English learners and foster kids, but that money's not actually being spent on those kids in school districts. So day one in this office, we're going to actually move forward, make sure that money is getting to the kids of greatest need and holding districts accountable if that's not what's happening, because our neediest kids, they need more support. I've learned that from my 15 years of leading public schools. And lastly, we got to bring a lot of innovation and creativity into our public schools.
All right, let's drill down on that, those 3 points. You talked about recruiting teachers. The state has a massive teacher retention problem. That is, the teachers it does recruit don't stick around for very long. What specifically would you do to address that?
You know, in our schools, as I mentioned, I led two different public school systems. What we did is we actually found our most effective teachers and gave them time during the school day to coach and mentor their peers. And this is also the work we did at the new teacher center. And it's been proven to work really well on retention. Actually, the districts that we work with in the new teacher center had huge increases in retention rates because you're giving teachers more of a chance to be successful by having them learn from their peers. Second thing we're going to do is at the state level, you know, every year we give certificates for teachers of the year and principals of the year. And we just give them a certificate and say, hey, great job. I want to give them $10,000 each and have them all do 3 to 4 Google Hangouts a month so that when a brand new teacher comes to be starts teaching algebra, they know that 10 of the best algebra teachers in the state, 3 to 4 times a month, are going online and sharing what lesson plan did they create? How do they actually deliver that lesson plan? How do they get the results for their kids? So we're going to do a phenomenal job about getting our most effective educators and having them share their best practices. And then lastly, you know, we've got to change our teacher training programs. You know, a lot of the reason that teachers leave their schools is because they're not trained well to be successful. And most of our teachers in public schools in California come out of the Cal State teacher training programs. State superintendent sits on the board for the Cal State. So we're going to dramatically improve those teacher training programs, put most of the curriculum and most of the book learning into undergrad. So that fifth year, you know, you have to have a fifth year if you want to go into teaching, that credentialing year is mostly spent in a residency learning from a phenomenal teacher. So that if my child has a brand new teacher, if any child has a brand new teacher, that teacher's learned for a whole year from a really good teacher before they're actually teaching kids. And if you both increase compensation and also increase supports for teachers, they'll stick around because teaching is a wonderful job. But we've got to treat our teachers the way they deserve to be treated, which is better support, better pay, and really then they'll lift up our kids.
To be clear, the only pay you made reference to just now was merit-based bonuses. What about base pay for teachers?
Well, no. So I mentioned one is I want to give free college if you commit to teach for 5 years, right, as a way to get more people to come in. Secondly, my focus is less merit pay. I think we should pay teachers more to work in the neediest schools. So like in the schools I led, we pay principals more to work in Watts and South LA and East LA than they can make in Beverly Hills. And that's essential because it's all, you know, it helped us get better and people, teachers that came, principals that came and stayed at our schools. And we know our low-income kids actually have much greater turnover of teachers and principals and others. And then we absolutely, to your point, have to increase base pay for teachers across the board. And we have to pay more for teachers that don't work in our neediest neighborhoods.
Price tag. How much additional money has to be going into the California public school system for it to meet the standards you think we should have?
Well, you know, right now we're 44th in the country in our public schools. Great state of California, wealthiest state in the nation, and our public schools rank 44th, right? It's unacceptable, and we need to do better for our kids. If we want to have schools that are in the top 10, you know, top five where they should be, you know, we say that's going to probably take at least a decade. And over time, we have to dramatically increase our funding for public schools. You know, if you want to go from 44th to middle of the pack, 25th, you got to probably increase it by five, you know, 8 billion. If you want to go from 44th to top 10, five, you know, some studies, recent study had it out that out of Stanford and Harvard that we got to increase it by 22 billion, right? That's not obviously going to all happen at once. And we also need to improve the system, you know, because putting more money in a system that's not working won't also get results, but we certainly have to increase it dramatically. And in the short term, I think there's some revenue sources out there that we can move over immediately to help support our public schools.
I want to refer back to something you mentioned. I think you were referring to the local control funding formula revision that was signed off on by Jerry Brown. You said funding is going to schools that serve needy kids, but it's not going to the kids. What did you mean by that?
It's going to school districts. So Governor Brown passed a law that gave additional dollars to low-income kids, English learners, and foster kids. I think it was probably the most important piece of policy passed in this state in the last decade on education because, you know, as I know from the work I've done, Rear Elementary School, one of our schools in Watts, like our kids were all coming low-income families and a lot of challenging circumstances. They require more money. So it's a great piece of policy. But that money goes to the districts. And what's been happening is the current state superintendent gave a ruling because the state superintendent interprets all of laws. So he told school districts that money could be used for across-the-board raises, even if the people that got additional dollars weren't serving low-income kids. So the money goes to the district, but the district isn't actually having that money get either to programs for low-income kids or to pay teachers, principals, and counselors more to serve low-income kids. A lot of that money, over $1 billion, has just been spent on across-the-board raises, even if people don't actually serve low-income kids or English learners. So we're going to change that interpretation on day one and make sure that the dollars get to our neediest kids.
You yourself just a few minutes ago pointed to low teacher pay as a problem facing California schools. Why don't you see spending money on raises for teachers as an investment in the children they're teaching?
Well, I do. It's just the raises should go to teachers who are teaching low-income kids. So here's the, like, think of it as a place like San Francisco, which has half low-income kids, half not low-income kids. If you give the money, if you get additional dollars and the money goes to across-the-board raises for everybody, it's actually no additional dollars to serve the low-income kids because the money's spread across all schools. I think it should definitely go to raises for principals and teachers, but for those that are actually serving low-income kids and foster kids. The schools I led, we doubled graduation rates. One of the reasons we were able to do that was because we paid principals more to work in tougher schools. We gave signing bonuses to teachers to work in tougher schools. And I think you have to change compensation there because our needier schools are harder jobs. And because they have, as you alluded to up front, huge turnover issues. We had 30% turnover in some of the schools that we started working at before we got there. So I absolutely think the best investment you can do on serving low-income kids is getting high-quality teachers, principals, and counselors there. So the money should be used for those raises. But what oftentimes it was used to actually pay for additional compensation or other things in schools that weren't actually serving low-income kids. That's the distinction.
Why not leave it up to the school districts to decide how to allocate that money? A few minutes ago, you were inveighing against the amount of restrictions that state-level rules place on local schools.
Well, this law was passed for additional dollars for low-income kids and for foster kids and for English learners. And I'm saying you can use that money however you want for those low-income kids, whether you want to pay teachers more, whether you want to have more school time, whether you want to have more counselors. Those decisions absolutely should be up to the school sites and to the school districts. But in terms of not using that money for our low-income kids and for our kids of color, that's a problem. Because the problem that the law is trying to solve is we have massive equity issues in the state of California. State of California, if you look at mathematics, Asian Americans are 75% proficient in math in California. Whites are 55%. Latinos are 27%. And African Americans are 20%. And these gaps have been this way for literally 40 years, massive gaps, and they're similar across economic levels. So we have to differentiate our supports for the neediest kids. And it is a fact. It's a fact in the state. Our low-income kids of color have less experienced teachers and principals that turn over more often, have more substitutes. If you don't actually have the dollars that are intended for low-income kids, go to low-income kids, you will never close the achievement gap. And we're guaranteeing, which we can't guarantee, but you won't improve things. And right now we have a state that's highly unequal. Low-income kids of color are getting highly ineffective public education, which means that their future is being taken from them. I've been in this work for 16 years, always focused on our neediest schools, have delivered strong results, and we absolutely need to give more dollars to fund the students of greatest need. That's what the law is intended to do, and let's make sure it's happening. And let's certainly give the decisions around what strategies to use for those kids to educators at school sites.
Marshall Tuck, we threw open the opportunity to ask questions to our listeners through a few different social media channels. And the theme that came up over and over, particularly from those of our listeners who are in Oakland, was on the question of charter schools. First of all, where do you land on the question of charters? Has California gone overboard? Has it not gone far enough?
I think nonprofit charter schools that are good and high performing, that's a key distinction, are a good thing for the 21st century public education system. And the reason I believe in that is middle class and upper class families have never been stuck in failing schools, right? Upper class can go to private school. They can move to, you know, Palo Alto, which has much better public schools. They can move to Piedmont. And middle class is able to move usually to kind of external suburbs or go to like a Catholic school. It's only our lowest income families that have literally for decades been stuck in failing schools. And I tell folks all the time, like, you know, I'm a Democrat because I believe government has a role to play to help the neediest kids and the neediest people in general. And we're not getting that job done in education. So the idea of giving another public school option, I think, as long as it's working well, is helpful. Now, that being said, most kids are in traditional public schools. That's where the focus needs to be. And I think that, you know, charter schools can be valuable when the system's not getting the job done for our traditional public schools. But let's get focused on turning around those schools, which is what I spent most of my career doing. I spent an early portion in charter schools, but most on turning around district public schools. You know, if you're improving those district public schools, then you don't need charters. But I certainly think that overall right now in California, where our schools are struggling so much, that nonprofit charters have a positive role to play if they're working well. If they're not working well, they should be shut down.
So let me break that down into a couple areas of concern. The first one, I guess, is what you would call cream skimming. It's that the charters that are performing exactly the way you describe peel off the kids who are bright, who have engaged parents, who cost less to educate and leave the public schools stuck with the special need kids, the kids who take more resources, even though the state per pupil allocation has gone with the other kids to the charter. That can represent a structural financial problem for a school district that's splitting its student population between public schools and charters, can it?
Well, if you're actually doing that practically, it's illegal, and the state and the district should step in. Like, charters by law have to accept all kids. I worked in charter schools early in my career. I actually helped create 10 new public charter schools, all serving the highest need kids in LA, and 8 of 10 are now recognized by U.S. News and World Report. And our kids were all low income, mostly Latino, some African American, you know, representing the demographics of the area, equivalent special ed percentages, and that's what's supposed to happen. So if charter schools are actually not taking all kids, that's illegal, and that's where I think the state and school districts have not done their job of stepping in, because you can see the data. I mean, a state superintendent, if we see data where a charter is in a district and they're not taking special education students, they're not taking appropriate numbers of foster EL kids, then we're going to step in and intervene and tell them they got to change right away, or you shut them down. Like, you got to serve all kids. All schools are public schools. And so that's where I think we just haven't had highly effective, you know, leadership in terms of the idea for charters was more flexibility, but for more accountability. We got to be better on the accountability, and they got to serve all kids. But I do think that giving families, particularly in certain parts of the state, parts of Oakland, parts of LA, parts of West Fresno, you know, lower income families, giving them an option is important. You know, when someone moves from, you know, San Francisco to Piedmont, they're choosing to go to different public schools. No one says they're taking money from the public schools by changing their schools, but they are choosing to change neighborhoods. I think I want to give that choice to low income families within their own neighborhood, another public school option, as long as it's good.
Right. I think what the Oakland schools are specifically wrestling with is just the sheer number of charters that have opened up in their district is hollowing out the remaining public schools and making it harder and harder to keep them operating. The way the state law works, as I understand it, they can't turn down new charter applications solely on the basis of the financial impact they'd have on the rest of the school district.
Well, I think to your point in Oakland's a good point where, you know, Oakland, you have a situation where you've got real financial challenges at the district for a lot of reasons, large charter school population. And many can say that the school district has too many seats, right? Like between the district schools and the charter schools, there's just a lot of schools. So I think you bring up the right question, which is like, in that situation, should there be more new schools opened, or should the charter school community and the district school community be working together to figure out, okay, given all the schools we currently have, how do we best serve all of our kids? And so I'd see a solution in Oakland. You'd like to see a state superintendent facilitating conversations between the school district and the charter school community out there to really say, hey, what's in the very best interest of all Oakland kids? And to your point, I haven't dug into the details, but you could see a scenario where a situation like that, we have a significant financial distress from a district and a lot of schools in the area. Are you better off having your charter school, your charter school operators and district collaborating on improving the current schools, rather than opening new ones?
That's not the question, though. The question is, should the elected Oakland school board be able to say no more new charters? Right now, they can't. There's an appeal process that goes around them straight to the State Board of Education.
Yeah, I support the appeal process. Like, I don't think that they should be able to unilaterally say no, because then you have a situation where a lot of districts might say no for the wrong reasons.
What's a bad charter?
Well, so charter by definition, to me, it's got to be performing at a higher level in terms of higher academics, in terms of less suspensions, less expulsions, better college acceptance rates. If you're a high school, better college completion rates over time. And if charters aren't operating at that level, if you look at all of their data, if charters are low on statewide proficiency rates, if they're too high in suspensions and expulsions, if they're not sending kids to college, that's not just about charters. That's for all public schools. Like that's an ineffective public school. And in the case of charter schools, because by law, they're supposed to be held accountable. If they're not hitting results that are improving things for our kids, then they shouldn't exist.
Can you name a charter that's operating today that you think should be shut down?
Well, there's actually a number. It's interesting. Like, I live in LA. In LA, there's a study that was done by Stanford that said overall, in LA, the vast majority of charters all serve low-income kids, because that's the reality of public schools in Los Angeles. I think the analysis had something like overall, about half the charters were substantially outperforming the district, a quarter were about the same, and a quarter were well below. A quarter, not just one or two, but a quarter. And so that's where you see a breakdown in terms of the authorization. Like, those schools shouldn't be renewed.
Can you name one that you would shut down?
Not off the top of my head, but there's plenty. I mean, I haven't dug into that recently.
One of the hits on you, I'm sure you're aware of it, is that a lot of the independent expenditures that have been supporting your campaign have been coming from people and organizations that are heavy promoters of charter schools. And the argument against your campaign is that creates some kind of conflict, puts you on an adverse footing with the functioning public schools. What's your response?
Yeah, when people talk about money, I first think about what can candidates control and then what's outside, and let's talk about both. So, candidate, I'm a candidate. We actually made a decision up front in this campaign to take no money from corporations or from PACs. And so all of our money is 100% from individuals. We have around 4,000 supporters in all different income levels, all different neighborhoods. My opponent, over 80% of his money comes from PACs and corporations, over 80%. And that's of the money that we control. And then if you look at what you mentioned, independent expenditures, the vast majority of his funding comes from the teachers union. A lot of my funding does come from people who support charter schools. Other, by the way, some of those folks are not strong advocates of charters.
Marshall Tuck, what do you see as the biggest contrast between yourself and your opponent?
I think it starts with experience. I've led two public school systems, all serving low-income kids, all that had uniquely strong results in terms of graduation rates, sending kids to college, college success, moving up in terms of student achievement results, down in terms of suspensions, expulsions. I'm an educator who's led public school systems. My opponent the last 15 years has been a politician, only 4 years on a school board. That's really been the only leadership experience in education. And those 4 years had some challenges. So I think it's this job is the top educator in the state, and it should be someone with strong education expertise and a proven background. And I think the state needs an educator, not just another politician. Certainly we need politicians in certain jobs, but this job is about the top education leaders. I think that's the biggest difference. And then, you know, we fundamentally in our campaign, we absolutely need more funding in this state, but we also need real change in our public schools. And I think that we're looking for how do you put a lot more innovation, how do you give a lot more flexibility, a lot more change in how we do this work. And I think there's some real differences there in terms of the how much change we believe we need from my opponent and I.
On your record, Tony Thurmond mentioned that he pushed a bill to expand funding for dual language immersion programs. There's an op-ed in the San Francisco Chronicle this month saying that when you were in charge of Ritter Elementary School, you drew a complaint from the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Education Fund for cutting the dual language immersion program there at a school that was 42% English learners. What's your response?
Yeah, so unfortunately, you know, as we see throughout this country, there's just a lot of false information there out there or highly manipulated information. We took over Ritter Elementary School in 2008. It was the, I think, the second or third lowest performing elementary school in Los Angeles, both for English learners and for our standard learners. Ritter Elementary School had both a kindergarten class and a first grade class. It did not have a comprehensive bilingual program. It actually had two classes, one kindergarten and one first grade, that was bilingual. The principal and the vast majority of teachers, including the chapter chair, the union chapter chair of that school, made the decision locally that they felt that one of the challenges of the school was they didn't have an aligned curricular program and that they wanted to get that into one place. And they felt that having only a two grade level bilingual wasn't successful for the kids. They chose to actually end those two classes. We supported that decision. It wasn't a decision that I made, but we supported it. And they moved forward, and that school had significant improvement for all of its kids, including for that large English learner population.
Again, that was Marshall Tuck, candidate for State Superintendent of Public Instruction. Until recently, he was a fellow at the New Teacher Center. He has more independent expenditure money backing his campaign than any other candidate for office on the state ballot, about $25 million to date, the vast majority from pro-charter school outfits. Now, if you were listening closely to the interviews with him and his opponent, Tony Thurmond, in the first half of this hour, you might have picked up on one factual disparity. They cited two different figures for where California ranks on per pupil spending in its schools. We looked into this to try to figure out who's right. It turns out there are a lot of different ways to calculate that number. It depends on what year you draw data from. It depends on how you calculate how many enrolled students there are. Is it how many students there are on the first day of classes in the fall, or the average daily headcount, because that is the denominator. And it depends on whether you adjust the spending for cost of living. So the least flattering estimate for California, the one that was cited by Tony Thurmond, comes from EdWeek. The last time they crunched the numbers, they were using 2013 to 2014 data. They were adjusting for cost of living, and they ranked California 46th in the nation. California's per pupil spending has been rising because the state budget has been expanding, and that triggers automatic spending increases on the school. So the ranking has gone up some since then. The most charitable estimation of California's rank comes from the National Education Association. They don't adjust for cost of living based on 2015 to 2016 data. They put California 22nd in the country. California Budget and Policy Center, using 2015 to 2016 data and adjusting for cost of living, puts us 41st. We have not seen a basis for the rank of 44 that Marshall Tuck cited during his interview.